This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome back to our continuing coverage. I'm Tony Bruschi. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're downloading podcasts so you don't miss any of our coverage in this case. Let's head to the courtroom for segment number two.
The jury is present, sir.
All right, thank you, and may proceed. The last exhibit has been withdrawn.
So let me have you do something we attempted a moment ago to use a page out of a book, and I think we're going to have you sketch this out. So here we go. How about step down, please, with permission of the court? Now let's stand on that side there. And do you remember what that page looked in the book?
Yes.
Okay, so what I want you to do is, if we can't put that in, to replicate that to the jury and tell them what it means.
Sure.
Okay, you want to take them one at a time?
Yes, I will.
Okay, great. Thank you.
So, talking about shotgun wounds to the body and trying to figure out what the range of fire is. A perfect circle, which I'm not a great artist, but let's just say that's a perfect circle. That means that the end of the barrel, right, nice circle, is pressed up against the skin. Now this would be down here on the abdomen where you have leeway, it would end up being a perfect circle. If you have it up where it's going up against something firm, then you would have the circle, but you'd have the splitting from that buildup of pressure. So this is a contact range. If we have some burning around it, contact range or close range. If we have soot around it, we're close range. Now, from the first picture that we looked at, all those pellets coming, and then they start to slowly open up. So now what we've got is sort of looks like a cloud, right? We call it scalloped margins. So now we're moving out a little bit further. We are, you know, in that area of maybe 2 to 3 feet or so. And then as we continue moving further and further, we get the scallop margins, but then we get holes, and it doesn't have to be perfectly around it, but we get holes from the individual pellets that have now moved out. And so if we start seeing individual pellets, we're saying usually the end of the weapon is 4 feet or further. And then to be more specific, is it 4 feet or 5 feet or 6 feet, then you have to test fire.
Okay, so so as the muzzle gets closer to the wound, there either is no spreading of the pellets, as in a contact wound, but the further away the pellets begin to expand, and the further away you get more of an individualized pellet pattern.
That's correct. It's like when it comes out, it comes out and it goes triangular. So it gets bigger, and as it goes triangular, it's almost like playing pool, and you take the cue ball and you hit the pool balls, the billiards, and they start to open up.
Okay, if you put up, is Defense Exhibit 162 in evidence? Okay, let me show it. You need to write on this book. While she's doing that, let me push this out of the way. Sure, is everything off over there? Please. What? Oh. Offer this into evidence, Your Honor. Without objection, and ask it be sealed.
Says the state. Submit it without objection.
Put it up on the screen, please. Okay, now, here we see, and if there's measurements here, a rather large wound on his shoulder, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And then a smaller wound in his chin.
Yes, sir.
What does that tell you about the directionality?
Well, it's not just that. It's also that we have no surrounding individual pellets, pellet holes. To me, looking at this, this is not going left to right. I can understand the thought that maybe it was like a tangential graze, but then the pellets wouldn't have gone down and they would have opened up onto the left chin. So again, using the totality of the evidence, these are pellets that are coming down from the top. They're starting to open up. They go through here and they have to go through another bone, so they're going to open up further and disperse through the left shoulder.
So, and maybe this is too simplistic, do shotgun wounds, do they, and of course, if you just testify, they expand, right? The pattern?
You'll get a different pattern, and for a certain distance, the actual hole will expand, but then you lose that hole and it becomes just individual small holes.
So you've got a smaller hole in his chin and a larger hole in his shoulder. Does that indicate anything? I mean, am I being too simplistic? Smaller means it's expanding at that point?
Right. Not to be offensive, I think it is a little too simplistic because we also have to look at what's around the wound. But yes, again, the totality of everything, this is definitely coming downwards from right to left. The only way I could see larger wound on the left shoulder, smaller wound on the left chin, is if you consider this a graze wound. But again, using the totality of everything, the size of this wound, the location of the pellets going down into the shoulder, this is not going left to right.
Okay. Now, let me also ask you this. If the wound is in the head and why isn't the brain macerated? Why isn't the brain shredded by those pellets? Why does the brain exit the skull, as we saw a minute ago, without being shot to pieces?
Because, again, you're having one, the shot shell.
Take it in.
You know, that's okay. Everything is still within that shot shell as it goes in. The pressure is just going to form around it and push it out. Sometimes you'll see, in my experience, a complete intact brain that may have some holes here and there. Sometimes you'll see a brain that is split in half, and sometimes you will see completely macerated. But from what I saw in the photograph and reading Dr. Reamer's autopsy report, she does state that the brain was received in another bag and that it was, I don't remember the exact words, but that it was severely traumatized.
But no, there's no x-rays of that brain.
There's no x-rays of the brain. I'm sure there are pellets within the brain.
And were there any shots? Do you see any actual autopsy photos of the brain? I mean, just the brain.
No, I saw scene photos, but I did not see autopsy photos of just the brain.
Okay. So you would not necessarily... Well, let me back off for just a second. You have actually done autopsies on contact wounds by a shotgun to the head?
Oh, yes.
And what you're telling us is based on that experience?
Well, experience, training, the textbooks. I mean, articles aren't written about it because it's fairly common knowledge.
Okay. And let me do a little housekeeping. I got a number of photos I want to show you that may be used, or were they used by you in reaching your opinion, okay?
Okay.
here so I can. Defendant's Exhibit 169, 168, 161, 160, and 159 to determine whether or not he relied on these to come to the conclusions he's come to. I don't think there's any need to publish them to the jury at this point, and I believe the defense, the state consents to their admission.
No,
if I might proceed.
Would you look at these photos, please?
Yes, sir. Okay.
Are those photographs, autopsy photographs or x-rays, that you relied on in reaching the opinions you've expressed to this jury today?
Yes, sir.
Your Honor, we'd offer these into evidence.
No
objection. I'm admitted.
For the record, we're offering Defendant's Exhibit 160, 161, 168, 169, and 159 and 160. I think I already said 160. Give those to you. And again, all under seal, please. So just a couple more questions. 162 is already in evidence, right? Okay. So let me hand that back to you before I do that. So the opinions you've given here today, you've given to a degree of medical certainty more probably than not?
Yes.
And you would agree with me that you're not an expert on the vectors of this shot, either one of any of these shots, except you talked about a probability on Maggie on the two shots that go down, right?
Right. I want to make sure I'm answering correctly. So I'm an expert on the directionality within the body that projectiles go, entrance, exit, the direction within the body. As far as, and I think this is what you're asking, as far as crime scene and reconstructing, things of that sort, that's not my area of expertise.
Okay, but you have given an opinion. I want to make sure that we all understand what you've said. You've given an opinion that Dr. Reamer was wrong on the shot that blew Paul's brain out of his skull and it landed on the ground, correct?
That's correct.
And you believe it was a shot in the back right of the skull.
Yes, sir.
And you believe that it was going through his skull, out his neck, and into his arm.
Into the left side, yes, sir.
Left side. And we found a number of x-rays showing the pellets. We've seen forensic evidence that you, in the normal course of your work, rely on to draw opinions, right?
That's correct.
And you've done that thousands of times.
Yes, sir.
And let me make sure that the jury understands this. When you're submitted materials like we submitted to you in cases, are you paid to give an opinion, a specific opinion?
No, I wouldn't accept a case if someone said this is what we want.
Okay. And you come to conclusions based on the materials given to you?
Absolutely.
And that's your conclusion here today?
The conclusions that I've stated, yes.
Take the court's indulgence. So you've indicated and testified that would be the blood, brains, pieces of skull, other material would blow out the direction of the hole and the muzzle of the gun would have been pressed against the skull, correct?
The muzzle of the end of the barrel of the shotgun,
right,
would be pressed against the skin firm enough that there would be pressure onto the skull, and then you would have blowback as the skull opened up.
And that blowback would follow the barrel of the gun?
Well, it would come back up the barrel of the gun, but it would also distribute.
Right. And what about the barrel of the gun? Would there be biological material jammed into that?
Absolutely.
I'm sorry?
Absolutely.
Okay. So there would be brains, blood, skull, whatever, jammed back up the barrel of the shotgun?
Right. Well, what we say is biologic material.
Okay. Thank you. Please answer any questions Ms. Goode has.
Hi, Dr. Eisenstadt.
Good morning.
Now, when you first started your testimony, you talked a little bit about time of death.
Yes.
Is it the pathologist's job to determine the time of death?
Depends on the jurisdiction, but pathologists are trained in talking about what's consistent or what's not consistent. But I believe, like in Georgia, I believe here in South Carolina, the coroner, in the majority of counties, the coroner goes to the scene and does the investigation. So I don't know how it works here, but there's no doubt that part of a forensic pathologist's training and knowledge is determining cause of death from information given to, time of death from information given to them.
And it's not customary for a pathologist to actually go out to the crime scene, is it?
Oh, I'd say more often than not, the pathologist does not go out.
All right, and now in this case, because this appeared to be homicides, the county coroner would be the one to have requested an autopsy. Is that right?
That's my understanding. Definitely in Georgia, it's my understanding here, yes.
And Dr. Reamer performed the autopsy here?
Yes, ma'am.
And she performed an independent autopsy?
She did.
Did you perform an autopsy of either of the victims in this case?
I did not.
And you relied on, I think you testified, that Dr. Reamer's report, x-rays, crime scene photos, and autopsy photos in determining your opinion.
That's correct.
And you were hired, right?
Yes, I was.
And you were here on Friday, weren't you?
I was.
So that would mean you've made over $10,000 in evaluating or taking part in this case.
At the end of the day, that's correct.
Did you do a report?
I was not asked to do a report, no.
Wouldn't you agree that a report would have been helpful to explain the scientific methods or investigation that you used to come to your conclusions?
Different jurisdictions do it differently. So I have no idea how it's done here, but I mean, my report would have been exactly the same as my testimony, so I guess it would be on paper instead of, verbally.
Well, you saw Dr. Reamer's report, and that was actually entered into evidence, right?
Yes, I did.
All right, you spoke a little bit about Maggie and
yes, that's
her
correct.
Autopsy. And I believe you said in your testimony that Maggie's shooter could be taller than Maggie. Is that right?
Oh, no, that's not what I said.
What did you say?
No. What we were talking about was if Maggie's gunshot or rifle wounds to the top of her head mm-hmm. and to the side of her head were with her standing up, mm-hmm. that would have to be somebody at an elevated position. Mm-hmm. So I didn't give an opinion that the shooter had to be taller because we talked about how she could be bent over.
Mm-hmm. But an elevated position could mean the shooter was taller, right?
Oh, but that... I mean, it could be that the shooter was taller, but that would still have to be somebody at an extremely elevated position shooting down. I'll leave it at that.
And you said that determining trajectory is not something that you do.
At the scene, that's correct. On the body, that's what I do all the time.
All right, let's move on to Paul. Would you agree that when a gun is shot, a lot of energy and momentum is generated, and that momentum and energy tears through a person's body?
Depending on the range of fire, the type of ammunition, yes, I agree with that.
And when pellets are shot, they spread out?
Eventually, yes.
Right. So, If Paul was shot in the back of the head and those pellets start spreading out, did they come back together when they exited this way?
No, but that's where we're talking about the same thing as range of fire. So those pellets, I mean, if you go from the top of the head down to here, this is about 6 inches, so we have about 6 inches. We have maybe a foot, right, from here to here. Those pellets can still be together and starting to spread out. So, no, they're not going to go out and come back together. Some, that's why I was talking about that billiard ball effect. Some, if you hit that cue ball, the side ones are going to pop out, and the middle ones will still be together. So, no, they won't go out and come back, but I have no issue with 1 foot from here to here and having still a whole cluster of pellets going through.
But the pellets would be closer together when they first enter the body.
For a certain distance, yes.
And we also talked about soot or stippling. Now, in Dr. Reamer's report, she does note that there was soot and stippling for certain injuries, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And she did not note that for the injury to the shoulder and head.
Agreed.
Okay. And wasn't the top of Paul's skull missing?
Yes, it was.
And Paul's face, it wasn't blown off, was it?
It was not.
His brains weren't splattered all over the floor?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you mean by that, but his brain left his head and ended up being on the floor. There were some smaller pieces in other areas and then a large piece in one area.
I'm going to show you what's been entered as Tapes 24 under seal. I don't know if you can tell from this picture.
I can.
Can you?
Yes, ma'am.
Does that brain look macerated or splattered everywhere?
No, but that brain has been extruded from the head, and there are, when you do a zoom in on it, unfortunately no x-ray, but when you zoom in on it, you can tell that there's injury to the brain, but the brain, yes, I agree, it's not macerated.
And there were pellets on the floor of that feed room.
That's my understanding.
I'm going to show you Tapes 26 and 43. Do you see that as the door to the feed room?
I do.
It's Tapes 43. That blood spatter on top of the door?
That looks like blood spatter at the top of the door, yes.
And no blood spatter out there on the sidewalk from his brain being blown out from his head and his face being left intact, right?
Right, the brain would come out the top of the head.
And it's on the top of that door.
I'm sorry, ma'am?
And the blood spatter is on the top of the door.
Right, that's blowback. That's from here, the pressure pushing it backwards.
And did you see any crime scene photos of the feed room where there were some containers on a shelf?
I did.
So the containers on the shelf, I believe, would be to the right side on this picture?
Looking at the picture, I believe, yes. Inside on the right, there's some shelves with a number of items on it.
And was there kind of a demarcation line showing blood going to the top of the feed room?
I don't recall, in all honesty, you're starting to get into an area that's not my area of expertise.
Into trajectory, is that right?
Outside of the body, yes.
And did you determine the manner of death for these victims?
I did.
What was that?
For both of them, it was homicide.
Thank you. Nothing further.
Anything further?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Thank you. You may step down.
Excuse. Thank you.
Your next witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. Defense calls Tim Palmbach to the stand, please.
Raise your right hand, left hand on the Bible. Do you affirm the testimony about to give the court in this trial shall be the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Thank you. Take a seat in the witness stand. Mm-hmm. You can adjust the mic if you have to. State your name again for the record. Spell your last name.
Timothy Palmbach, Palmbach.
Mr. Palmbach, will you tell the jury where you're from and what do you do?
I'm from Connecticut. I've been up in that state for the majority of my life. Most of my career has been in the Connecticut State Police, and I actually started out in a row position. Then I was transferred into a major crime unit, and from there I spent a good deal of my time in the lab. I retired as a major from the lab in 2004, and at that time I was head of the whole Division of Scientific Services for the state of Connecticut. I then went back to the school, which was my alma mater, which was University of New Haven, to teach. I took the chair of forensic science position, which is a large forensic science program with both graduate and undergraduate students, and I managed that program as well as teaching. In addition to that, I was doing some degree of consultation, expert consultation, but not much just because of the volume of work that I had. In August of last year, the university offered me an early retirement incentive package, which I gladly accepted. And so now I just teach part-time, assist with a couple of the grants that I had, and have a little bit more time to do consulting.
When you were with the Connecticut Forensic Science Division, who did you work under? Who did you train under?
Dr. Henry Seeley.
And who is Dr. Lee?
Within the field, he is one of the original founding fathers and very, very well regarded as holistically as a forensic scientist, but very much so as a crime scene reconstruction expert.
And you mentioned, in addition to teaching and your prior work in the field, you currently do consulting as well?
Yes, I do.
Before we get to that, do you hold any certifications in your field of specialty?
So certifications, I have memberships. It's more of a membership organization than a certification.
Sure. So what's the American Academy of Forensic Science?
Sure. American Academy of Forensic Science is like the American Medical Academy or American Bar Association. It's kind of the large entity that all the professionals belong to. You have to be a practicing practitioner in good faith in order to do that. And then you go, it ranks from an associate member to a member, and eventually if you meet the criteria, you can be a fellow. So I'm a fellow of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences.
And what is the International Association for Identification?
So the IAI, or International Association of Identification, they tend to have membership and certification in areas like fingerprint examination as well as crime scene analysis.
And you're a member of that?
I am.
Association? And are you a member of the International Association of Blood Spatter Analysis?
I am, and the name is exactly that. So the membership there are individuals who had the requisite level of training, experience. I believe they even make you or demonstrate you qualified in court before, and then they'll grant you membership in that organization.
What? seems self-explanatory to you, but maybe not everyone in the courtroom. What is blood spatter analysis? And it's spatter, not splatter, correct?
It is spatter, correct.
All right.
Well, the basic course would be 40 hours, and I don't think they want to hear the basic course. And I don't mean that flippantly. There's a fair amount to it. The simple way to explain it is we're looking at energy and force applied to sources of blood or other mechanisms and activities applied to blood and then determining the patterns that result from that. And once we understand that, you know, that's much of what the training is in a lab and environment. You create these patterns, you study the patterns so you understand them. Then it's going to a scene, seeing these patterns, properly interpreting them, and drawing conclusions from them. So that's the short version of what it is.
And I believe you're also a member of the Massachusetts Forensic Science Oversight Board. Is that correct?
Yes, I am.
And what is that?
That's a governor's board that they bring in experts from around the country of different specialties, and we look at practices and protocols within the forensic science community within the state of forensic science. So it's essentially an advisory board.
I believe you also have a law degree?
I do, sir.
Why would you do that?
That's a good question. I haven't practiced law. It was back in the early 90s, there was a lot of stuff going on related to new technologies, DNA being the biggest of all of them. And what was happening for lab directors, and I was an assistant lab director at that time, is we spent more time in the court or writing papers in support of new testing and not knowing anything about it. So many of us, myself included, said, if this is going to be a big part of our job, we have to go back and learn it. So that's what motivated me to go back and do it.
And then currently, professionally, are you the executive director of the Henry C. Lee Institute of Forensic Science at UNH?
I was, but I gladly, when I went to emeritus status, gave that position up and got a little bit of time back. But I had been for 19 years prior to that.
And have you, as part of your consulting work, have you been qualified as an expert in state and federal courts in various states?
I have.
Do you know what states?
Oof. All right. Connecticut, New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, California, Illinois, Alabama, yeah, I think so. North Carolina for sure. I think I got it.
And what are your areas of expertise that for which you've been qualified and that you wish to be qualified in this court?
In the big genre, it's crime scene reconstruction and analysis, and sub-disciplines underneath that independently are bloodstain pattern interpretation and shooting incident reconstruction.
One of the cases, I believe, would State v. Michael Peterson. Were you an expert in that case?
I was, sir.
And was that the stair-step case?
I think it's known as the staircase case, yeah.
All right. Have you ever not been qualified as an expert in crime scene reconstruction, bloodstain analysis, and shooting incident reconstruction in any court, state or federal?
No.
Your Honor, at this time I would offer Mr. Pombach as an expert witness in the area of crime scene reconstruction, bloodstain analysis, and shooting incident reconstruction.
Says the state.
Is it blood stain analysis or blood splatter analysis or splatter analysis?
The field is referred to as blood stain analysis. Blood splatter would be a subcomponent of the greater field, yeah.
No objection.
He's admitted without objection.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Pombach, were you hired by Mr. Harpootlian and I on behalf of the defendant, Alec Murdoch, in this case?
I was.
And what were you hired to do?
To review the case, look at the forensics evidence, the pattern evidence, crime scene documentation, lab analysis, autopsies, and related investigative reports that dealt with the scene activity and the physical evidence.
And what are you charging for your time?
I am.
How much do you charge?
I do it as a block rating just simply because I don't want to keep track of hours. So my initial retainer fee was $5,000. I will have another finalizing fee as I complete here. Last night I scratched it out. I believe it's going to be $8,000 more plus travel expenses.
And did you come down here Friday and did not get to testify and spent the weekend in the low country?
Yeah, I showed up Thursday, actually. But, yeah, I've been here for a bit.
All right. What have you reviewed in this case? What materials have you been provided?
Again, lots of photographs, crime scene photographs, evidence photographs, autopsy records data, x-rays, various lab reports, investigative reports, diagrams created by investigating personnel, and reports that were related to those diagrams.
Now, upon your initial review of the autopsy reports, did you make any suggestions to us?
Once I agreed to take the case, that material was submitted, and I began to just review it. And that's what I usually do, is read through it and see, you know, get a sense out of what makes sense. One of the areas that I was very concerned with right away was looking at the shotgun wound to Paul. And based on all my training and experience, what we visualize in the head is absolutely consistent with a contact wound. Reading through the report, it didn't say that. It was written obviously as an exit wound, with the contact being down in the left shoulder and the left face. I think within a day, I called back to Attorney Harpool and yourself and said, this doesn't look right to me. It's inconsistent with my interpretation of the results. And my best advice for you would hire a forensic pathologist to review the case.
And were you sitting here in the courtroom when Dr. Eisenstadt testified?
I was.
And before coming to town to Walterboro Thursday, Friday, had you ever met Dr. Eisenstadt before?
No.
Had you ever worked with Dr. Eisenstadt before?
No.
Did you talk to Dr. Eisenstadt at any point in time before you arrived here in South Carolina for this case?
No.
Did you have an opportunity to go to Moselle?
I did.
And when was that?
Friday morning.
Okay. Was that your first physical trip to Moselle?
Correct.
Okay. And we'll get to some of the things that you located. Generally, overall, I want to first address the shooting of Paul. As you reviewed everything and tried to reconstruct the crime scene, can you give the jury an overall picture of Paul's murder? How did it occur?
Sure. I believe it began with Paul, his right shoulder to the open feed door. This is with inside the feed room, and he's facing straight ahead. And he's upright, and his arms are more or less at his side. And the first shot comes in a very oblique angled shot into his chest, travels through his chest, exits the side of his chest, into his left arm, exits his left arm, and then continues on and exits through a window pane in the feed shed, which is the opposite side from the doorway.
Roughly, where would the shooter have been on the first shot in Nepal?
Where would the shooter have been?
Yes, sir.
Okay, they're definitely going to be outside the door, and how close they are to the door is subject to a lot of different factors. So first of all, what's reported is a small amount of gunshot residue in that area, not a lot of it. And in fact, as I looked at it, yeah, I could see some of the particulate matter adjacent to the medial side of the injury. But I couldn't see much more gunshot residue beyond that. Now, in fairness, when you have an article of clothing and you're shooting through the article of clothing, the majority of the gunshot, if not all of it, depending upon the distance, will stay on the outside of the clothing. In this case, it was black clothing, blood-filled clothing, and you wouldn't be able to see that unless you did some enhancements or use something we call like a modified Grace reagent test.
Well, let me stop you there. Did you see any indication that SLED did any GSR testing of the clothing?
I did not.
Okay. All right. Please continue.
A GSR pattern testing of the clothing.
Correct. I'm sorry.
Okay. However, I'm not going to dispute what I read, that there was a minor bit of stippling there. But a minor bit of stippling there with a shotgun is going to give you a necessary minimum distance of 2 to 3 feet from the wound to the end of the barrel. The other factor you have to take into consideration is both of the shot shells that have been associated with the shooting of Paul were found within the feed room. Now, while the shotgun's never been recovered, and we really don't know the action and how it worked, it is a reasonable assumption that it's a semi-automatic variety, and that therefore, as an individual pulls a trigger, it'll eject to the right out of the port. So in order for the two casings to be within the feed room, the probability is that at least the receiver part, the ejection area, has got to just be inside the doorway minimally in order for the casings to stay inside of there.
All right, I'm going to stop you right there. You said it was a semi-automatic firearm. Why do you say that?
Well, we don't know. We clearly don't know because we don't have the weapon. Options could be a single shot. That doesn't make much sense. You'd have to shoot and stop and reload and shoot again. It could alternatively be a double barrel. But in my review of the firearms report from the state lab, they indicated that their examination of those two shot cartridge cases were that they came from the same weapon, that they were co-aligning them to one weapon. In the case of a double barrel, you have separate breech face areas, you have separate firing pins, and you're not going to get the two casings to look exactly the like. So that more or less took the probability of a double barrel shotgun away, and I think the logical inference is it's a semi-automatic. It could also be a pump-based action, but again, that's an additional stipulation.
Sure. Is there any indication that Paul had an opportunity to defend himself? Were there any defensive indications?
So I frankly think he was startled by that shot. His right shoulder was at the door. I mean, if he knew somebody was coming and or saw somebody coming, he would be facing the door or turning, trying to run, which he wouldn't have anywhere to go. But he was essentially facing this way, and the door is this way. I don't think he even perceived it until he was shot the first time. And you asked the question, did I see any defensive injuries or any indication of defensive actions on him or in the feed room? The answer is no.
What type of defensive indications have you seen in the past that would indicate that there was a struggle of some sort?
Well, I think obviously your hands always kind of come up, and his hands would be going up in the direction of the shooter and the weapon. So the orientation of his body would have changed. His hands coming up means that he likely, they could have been injured. Certainly there could be gunshot residue distribution on them. There could be,
sure.
Yeah, that would be the main difference.
Okay. And what was the ammunition in the first shot in the Paul?
That was buckshot. So it's about 38 caliber pellets.
And I think you mentioned that the spent shell was found inside the feed room. Is that right?
Correct.
All right, let's move on to the second shot of Paul. Can you reconstruct that generally, and then we'll get to some photographs?
Sure. Based on the general morphology of what happened to the head, this explosive nature, it's taught that way, we've learned it that way, and through personal experience, you never see that except when you have a high-energy source contact wound. The reason I say a high-energy source contact wound, if you took a little .22 caliber revolver and held it to the head, you will not see what we saw here. Simple reason being is it's not creating anywhere near the volume of what we're talking about, these gases, this high volume of gases that you get with a shotgun or a rifle. Effectively, why? Well, the barrel of the shotgun is going to be longer, it's wider, and so that you have this whole big area within the barrel that's being pressurized, and that just creates an exponentially a whole lot more gaseous material than you would have seen in a handgun. So seeing that head in the condition it was, that is a contact wound from a high-energy source weapon, which would understandably be a shotgun or a high-powered rifle.
Now, I don't want to repeat what the jury just heard, but were you sitting here in the courtroom when Dr. Eisenstadt, explained the mechanism of the head to the shot?
I heard that, yep.
Shot to the head, I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
And is that, do you agree or disagree?
Yeah, no, of course I agree. Completely agree.
Now, we'll get to this shortly, but the there's on the door, as it swung open, at the top, there's hair. It looks like paws, and there's blood at the top. Is that inconsistent with your assessment of how the shot happened?
No, actually, it's completely consistent with that.
Well, explain that, please.
So what happens is the barrel is in alignment and tightly against the head. And again, the shot goes into the head. The gaseous material begins to build. And again, this is, again, milliseconds is right, very, very quickly. It's beginning to swell and build. At the same time, the shot, the wadding, is starting to move down toward the exit area and come out. And then the head finally goes from the pressure. It can't go. And as it goes, the pressurized gases are going to find the quickest area to escape, and then they're going to redirect in that format. That ends up being the entrance hole. So you kind of get like a shift in action here, and all of the energy now is kind of recategorized, and it's now pushing up toward the corner of the ceiling and the door.
Now, you have you seen Dr. Kinsey's photograph of the door, and what is a crime scene photo, and there's a little ding in the door.
I have seen that.
Did you go out and inspect that on Friday?
I did, because you could clearly see a little ding, and I totally agree that could have been a pellet impact, but it was taken at that time. It was taken at a little bit of an angle, and I felt it would be better if I get up and get 90-degree and closer view and examine it myself, and I did.
And while you were there, did you also see any other pellets in the feed room that you attribute to the shooting of Paul in the head?
So first of all, in close examination of the impact on the door, I do believe that's from a pellet, and actually the dimensional size of it is consistent with the diameter of a number two steel shot pellet. And it is also, it was elongated, so you could see that it was coming from the bottom up. Quite near there, probably only a foot away, on the header, the trim header of the door, there was another one of these steel pellets, again, the right diameter, actually embedded in the wood. It's still there today. Going back, and I'll be honest, I did not see that in the photograph. Going back and looking at the photographs, I confirmed, yeah, it actually was present the day of the shooting.
So, Mr. Palmbach, how is it that a shot going down into the head could lead to pellets causing indentations in the door and getting stuck in the header of the door?
An explosion really is the best way to do it, but it's not just this kind of an explosion. It is like the military would call it, a chafe charge, you know, where you focus the explosion in a narrow pathway, and that creates a much larger damage area. And that's what happened here. You expanded the skull plate, and it pushed back through, first of all, pushed back through the actual entrance hole of the skull. And as that happened, then the skull breaks and pulls out. But there's now a very large energy moving this way, and it's drawing with it things as heavy and large as the entire brain. But it's also grabbing blood, it's grabbing tissue, it's grabbing skin, it's grabbing hair, it's grabbing the bone fragments, and it's grabbing part of the steel shot that's still in the skull cavity, and it's pushing it at a pretty reasonable velocity up and toward that corner of the door and the ceiling.
There's a, and we'll get to photos, but there appears to be the wadding that in the middle of the feed room on the floor. In your opinion, where did that come from?
It came out from inside the brain. That obviously made it through the brain. It was in the brain. And again, remember, the wad has these little fingers that tend to open and flare out like that. As a matter of fact, if you look at it in the photograph, you can see that it was flanged. The fingers were folded back. So it kind of is a breaking power, right? It's not going to go through the rest of the brain and out the side of the face and into the shoulder as easily as a pellet will. So it stopped more or less in the brain, and then it got caught up in this explosive force. I'm assuming it just went up in, it could have gone up into the shooter. It could have gone up into the door. Could have gone up the ceiling and wherever anyone was there, it could have happened and fallen down on the floor where we find it.
And I want to talk about the shooter. How close would the shooter have been in relation to the shot into Paul's head?
Well, so this is contact. So he's got to be close enough to get the barrel in contact, firm contact with his head. We don't know what that gun is. I don't know what, is it an 18-inch barrel length, a 26-inch barrel length? We don't know that. Obviously, that's going to change the difference. But he's, and the shot is somewhat overhead downward. So all of that is bringing this shooter much closer to Paul than when he took the first shot with Paul standing upright.
So we see indentations from a pellet in the door. We see a pellet stuck in the threshold of the door. What's happening to the shooter in this, in your reconstruction of a contact shot to the back of the head, what's happening to the shooter at that point?
He's getting hit with large amounts of brain material, blood, skin, hair, bone fragments, and I believe very likely some of the pellets.
And what would be the force of that hitting the shooter?
Substantial. And the reason we know that is, we've seen what's happened to the skull, how badly damaged it was. And secondarily, we have two of the pellets. One is actually denting this metal door, and another one is embedding in the wood above it. That, you know, I can't quantify that force, but that's substantial force. And that's the kind of energy that's taking all of the brain, all the fluid, all the tissue, and all the hair, and all the broken skull pieces, and sending it. Principally, it's going to follow right along the barrel pathway, you know, around it for sure, but that it's going to go in the same direction, essentially, that the barrel had been placed.
Would you expect to see any type injuries to the shooter?
That's quite possible. I mean, for sure, they're literally covered in all of that material, for sure. But given the size of the bones, the amount of the bone, and now pellets coming back at them, if any of them hit him, it's going to be an injury, whether it's substantial or just a stinging injury. Yeah, I think that's possible, actually probable.
And how much biological material and blood is going to be on the shooter's clothing and on the shooter's person?
A lot on the upper body and head.
I mean, if the shooter has thick hair, something a lot different than what I have, would you expect it to be matted in the shooter's hair?
Certainly. I mean, you're going to be covered on any surface, but yeah, I guess the thicker the hair is, the probably more it will retain in there.
And we have pictures of the room showing blood in various places throughout the room, right?
Exactly. So you have this core high velocity, kind of high volume pattern going up to the corner. But you also, this hole in the side of the head it's like this. It's very large. And so once that's open, there's still a lot of energy right there, and there's blood and tissue right there. You're also then going to just literally blow volumes of that, and that's what we're seeing throughout the room. That's why you're seeing it, you know, on shelves and on the door trims and on this wall and on this wall over here. With the exception, if you really look at it, there are some areas that have a void appearance, which to us would indicate there was something there that absorbed the blood that should have been there. And in this case, it would be the shooter's position.
And again, we're going to get to some photos and walk through that a little bit more. But I want you to now address this sort of an overview. Dr. Kinsey's, reconstruction based on Dr. Reamer's autopsy, where the shot is being made from a different angle. Do you think that's possible in this case?
Oh, I don't think at all it's possible that was the shot came the way that Dr. Reamer articulated. I think probably Dr. Kinsey, and I don't blame him, relied on that information that was provided to him by Dr. Reamer. He began to conduct his analysis based on that information, which was wrong.
But as to the angle of the gun, do the angles work out where you could take this shot from the outside?
So You have to look at the shot distribution evidence. We'll talk about gunpowder residence. We'll look at where blood spatter is located, and then we'll look at where we see, you know, this pellet and other projected spatter coming back. None of that is consistent with the lower trajectory upward shot that Dr. Kinsey articulated, and all of it is consistent with an overhand contact shot to the back of Paul's head.
Okay, well, let's start walking through these photos. And we'll start with Defendant's Exhibit 162, which is in evidence. And please cover your screens. This is under seal, and it's can you pull it up, Doug? Okay. Do you recognize this photo?
I do.
And what is it?
This is showing the left side of Paul's face and the left shoulder and the injury in that area.
Now, can you explain the significance of the size of the two different wounds, one in the side of the jaw and one in the shoulder?
Yes, the shoulder is much larger and much more diffuse and spread out. The side of the neck is a bit more circular and certainly smaller. And then if you look at the shoulder injury, again, it's substantively larger, and you can see, you know, damage, a lot of tissue damage in that area. And you can even from this photograph visualize easily one of the pellets that's still present, more or less up on top of that area.
Sure. Now, as a shotgun, pellets even enter the body, do they continue to spread out or exit the body and spread out?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Again, it's all about distance. You know, in order, your spread, the distribution of spread is a factor of distance travel.
And we're not going to pull up the other autopsy photo, but do we in fact see that under Paul's arm? This individual pellet says it exits under his armpit.
Sure. And then you actually can see the effect of spread over distance, because by the time those pellets hit the window behind there, which is, you know, 5, 6, 7 feet, now you start to see the spread of the shot.
Okay. I'm going to show you, Mr. Palmback, finish Exhibit 190, 191, and ask if you relied upon these in your analysis.
I did.
Your Honor, we move Exhibits 190, 191 in evidence under seal at this time, I believe without objection.
No objection.
They're admitted.
Doug, if you could pull up 190, please. Now, will you tell us, Mr. Palmback, what this photo depicts and how it relates to your analysis?
Well, this is showing the final resting position of Paul, this is obviously after both of the shots, and where he's located. You obviously can see the brain is located on to the left of him, against his left leg, and there's a substantial amount of a spatter in this area, around in transfer and pooling by his feet in the doorway. And you see that his feet are more or less on the, if you were standing on the outside, it would be more or less on the right side of the doorway, and then the rest of his body angles a little bit more toward the left from that once he's outside.
Does this photo inform your opinion as to where Paul was probably standing or kneeling at the time he received the fatal blow to his head?
Well, this photo in conjunction with several other photos in that area, but yeah, yes, it does inform me his motion between the two shots.
And let's go to 191, also under seal. And again, is this just from a different angle?
It's from the other side, yeah. And so you're now looking more at the left side. And again, you can see the large brain mass, you know, somewhat near his left knee area. But you can also see a fairly large piece by his of brain material by his left ankle. And then there's more, maybe 18 inches away from his body, kind of adjacent with his his belt or hip area. There's also what appears to be a large fragment of skull on the ground, maybe a foot off of the cement pad.
All right. I'm going to show you three more photos. I'll show you one, finished exhibit 192 and 165, and ask if you relied upon those original conclusions.
I did.
And what are they?
They're views principally of the floor area within the feed room.
All right, thank you. Your Honor, we move defendants 165 and 192 into evidence at this time without objection, I believe.
No objection.
They're admitted.
And Doug, if you'll pull up 165, please. And what do we see here, Mr. Palmbach?
Again, it's looking downward at the feed room, so you can see this from the area of the stoop, and then heading back into the kind of the feed bag, and you'll see that yellow placard number one, and what I can deduce from that, and let's focus with the placard area number one and the blood stain that's on the floor in that area, that is classified as we call a vertical drip pattern, and that occurs when blood from above comes down. I believe that what that blood is attributed to is the chest wound. And so, you know, the shot came into the chest. Of course, the chest entrance is going to start bleeding, but as long as Paul is upright, you're really just, gravity's going to kind of just flow that down, you know, his shirt, and that'll kind of catch it. We won't see that on the floor for a period. But the shot then came out of his chest, into his arm, and out of his arm. So you've got, you know, 17 or 18 different holes here. There's lots of opportunity for this to bleed. And in fact, it did, and you can see the blood running down his arm. And so I think what you're seeing in those accumulations of droplets on the ground is the positioning now post that first shot of his left arm bleeding. And then you can begin to see some movement away from that toward the door.
All right, Doug, go back to, yeah, thank you. So did we see the wadding there by the number one?
Correct.
And is that the wadding from the headshot?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And, all right, back up, Doug, and go to the threshold, the entry of the, can you enlarge that? Yes, thank you. Can you tell us what this is?
So there's a couple things going here. You know, one, it might be, can I come down a point?
Yes, please.
It might just be easier. Your Honor, is that okay?
Go regular size, and then don't make that so tight, but cut it in half. There you go. Thank you. You probably want to stand over here.
Other side,
Tim, so you don't block your streams.
Yeah. Okay. First of all, again, these areas here are the vertical drip patterns that I was alluding to, and again, you can see them beginning to move in this direction. And you'll even see a couple of the larger droplets here, again, moving toward the door. Again, these are coming from Paul as he's moving away, more or less kind of from the center part of the room, toward the doorway. But an area I think that's really worth paying attention is this area of the floor here, and then this little bit of trim here. And this is a second impact area. This is not directly related to what we're seeing up on the ceiling, although it is related to the overall event of him receiving that headshot. And I believe what we're seeing here is after he's moved sufficiently that he's now moving toward that doorway, and the door jamb right here, and in this area here is where he's going to receive this shot. And as he receives this shot here, it's going to exit from his lower face, and it's going to hit the shoulder.
As it's coming out of the lower face, it's coming with a volume of blood and tissue. And then that's going to get slammed basically right into the shoulder where the shots are, and that's going to create another projection independent. And that's going to line up for us that his head is located right in, it's a, you know, about a foot or so off the ground and pretty close proximity to the edge of this trim board. And you can see the resulting spatter in this area, which all supports that impact site and is consistent with that being the projection of the shot out of his head through his lower side of his face and into his shoulder.
So are you saying that the blood spatter on the floor there that you just pointed out is from the exit wound from the chin and back into the shoulder?
Correct.
That wraps up segment number two in our continuing coverage of the trial of Alec Murdaugh. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our coverage. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.